We've spent too much time, I guess, in the over the last few years, along with every other media outlet, talking about the horrific war in Syria. Yet there's another in the Middle East, just as violent, just as dirty. And in Yemen, the conflict between Houthi rebels, Shia Muslims, and the Sunni government of President Hadi is in its second year, and it's almost invisible in the media. Now, why? What observers say in part, it's because of the third party in the war, the controversial Saudi-led coalition which is wreaking havoc with weaponry they purchased from the UK and the US. Now, earlier this year, you will recall a UN report highlighting the Saudi coalition's indiscriminate bombing of civilians, medical facilities, essential infrastructure, and food warehouses. Human rights observers say that the UK and the US are culpable. Having sold bombs and warheads to the Saudis, they have a duty to ensure they're not being used in ways which blatantly violate international laws. And if all that wasn't bad enough, recent reports suggested the utter lack of law and order in Yemen has created a vacuum which is being filled by Al-Qaeda, who've created their own mini-state within the country. Joining me to talk about the war we forgot about is Dr. Elizabeth Kendall. Elizabeth is a scholar of Yemen at Pembroke College in Oxford and a scholar of jihadi poetry. I hope to get to that later. Elizabeth, a very warm welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Elizabeth, can you outline in broad strokes what the war is about?
In broad strokes, the war really is about the rush to power of rebel forces known as the Houthis, who swept down from the north of Yemen to take control of the capital, Sana'a, in late 2014, and then tried to grab ever-increasing amounts of power in Yemen's capital, including actually kidnapping the prime minister at one point in early 2015, until the legitimate, as it's perceived internationally, perhaps not internally, government of Yemen was forced to retreat, and Saudi Arabia decided in March last year to step in and launch airstrikes against the rebel forces who'd occupied the capital. Now, the world media has tended to see this in a sectarian frame as a battle between the takeover of the Houthis, who belong to a sect, a very watered-down sect of Shiite Islam, and the, as they perceive it, legitimate government of Yemen, which is largely Sunni-based. Although I believe, and many other experts believe, that seeing the war in this framework of sectarian discord between Sunnis and Shiites is not actually accurate on the ground in Yemen.
How did Saudi Arabia get involved, Elizabeth?
Well, of course, Saudi Arabia has always been heavily involved in its southern neighbor, Yemen. It's always tried to, let's say, help society there by putting in large amounts of funding and thereby also making sure it has some modicum of control over the political apparatus. As this appeared to be slipping away, Saudi Arabia, I guess, felt that it had to take a stance and that it had to prove that it could also operate semi-independently from the United States, particularly at the time when the war started in March 2015, as the nuclear peace talks were progressing with Iran. I guess Saudi Arabia, rightly or wrongly, felt that Iranian influence was expanding in the Arab world, in the Middle East, and that it needed to be checked. Saudi Arabia believed that Iran was behind the Houthi rebel advances. Now, there is some evidence that Iran was helping the Houthis, was arming them, and it's certainly the rhetoric coming out of Tehran was pretty aggressive. But I think that framing the conflict as an Iranian attempt to gain control over Saudi Arabia's immediate neighbor is massively overplayed. And if you think about it rationally, all really Iran had to do was to make the right noises, rattle its sabers, supply some arms, and, you know, talk a bellicose talk, and then sit back, fold its arms, and wait for Saudi Arabia to exhaust itself militarily, in terms of its international reputation, and thereby create for itself a much, much greater problem as Yemen destabilized, as many in its population, up to 80%, became food insecure, and as rival militia factions and tribal factions started to come to the surface.
So this is another rightly and wrongly story, and there's a little bit of truth on both sides.
I think there's a little bit of truth on both sides, as there usually is. But where we are today, just a year after the coalition, the Saudi-led coalition airstrike started, is in a much worse, less stable, more insecure and terrorist-friendly environment than we were a year ago. So I would not say that Saudi had achieved really any of its aims.
I understand that they've been at war with the Houthis 6 or 7 times.
Yes, that's correct. You can date back what we would probably term outright wars to round about 2004. And to think that really the problem had still not gone away after a force as mighty as Saudi Arabia, with the help of the Yemeni government at the time, had been trying to battle the Houthis, you'd have thought that one would have realized that this problem cannot be solved militarily. In fact, the WikiLeaks telegrams that came out, I think, around about 2009, included clear statements from the U.S. embassy in Sana'a saying the Houthi problem can never be settled militarily. And anyone who thinks that that's the case is fooling themselves.
My guest is Elizabeth Kendall, Senior Research Fellow at Pembroke College, Oxford. Now, yes, the US and UK are effectively propping up the Saudi coalition. They've offered them training, intelligence and weapons. But I hadn't realised it was on such a mind-boggling scale. Some reports say that London has licensed the sale of an estimated $10 billion worth of weaponry, and the US another $20 billion.
These are the reports coming out. I'm not in a position to independently verify those figures, but lots of trusted sources are quoting them. And, of course, that is now causing internal political problems in the UK and I think increasingly in the US, as the populations see the devastation that's being wrought in Yemen. And, of course, a UN report that was made public in January this year pointed up very clear examples of violations of international humanitarian law with regard to Saudi airstrikes, which have unfortunately taken in many, many civilian targets, ranging from factories to schools to even Médecins Sans Frontières hospitals. And whether or not one can absolutely categorically verify that these were intentional strikes, I think when the number recorded amounts to about 120, I think it's 119 violations recounted by the United Nations, you have to concede that there must be some intentional targeting here. They cannot all be mistakes.
As you're well aware, Australia likes to rush in and be and join coalitions of the willing in the region, but as far as I know, we're not involved in this one. But you've been in some of the parliamentary, or in on some of the parliamentary debates about the UK supply of weapons to the Saudis. What sort of response has the government given to the charge that it is abetting war crimes?
Well, of course, the government has denied that it's abetting war crimes. But it's interesting to see how the denials have shifted slightly over time. I think now that there's very little question over the poor targeting that has resulted from many of these airstrikes. So the debate appears to be moving more in the direction of, can we actually prove that British-made weapons or US-made weapons were used in those precise strikes? which is an interesting shift of the debate. And in the last, in one of the last really devastating strikes on a market in the north of Yemen, a civilian marketplace, this was in the middle of March, about 100 civilians were killed. Now, it's true that six or seven Houthi rebel fighters were also killed in that strike. But you cannot justify the killing of six or seven fighters alongside 100 civilians.
Well, to come back to back to the point we were making together earlier, and that is the lack of international attention. Okay, there's 106 people as opposed to 34 in Brussels. That gets international attention, whereas the Saudi attack got no media.
Well, I think sadly this is always the case. When it's close to home, you feel it more. And the chances of those of us looking at our news screens actually being in Brussels airport was far greater than us being in a marketplace in northern Yemen. Therefore, we care greatly. But what we don't always do is look ahead to the impact of what's happening in Yemen and to how it will ultimately filter through to destabilize our societies at home. Of course, there's an argument to be made about the humanitarian loss of life and the tragedy in Yemen itself, and that's obvious. But I think we only really start to sit up and notice when we think it's going to impact us directly. And one point I think we've been missing is that the longer that the destabilization in Yemen continues, the more likely we are to see ramifications at home, both by being implicated in supporting the coalition and by, as a result, allowing a breeding ground to develop, a safe haven for terrorists in Yemen who ultimately do want to target us.
The Dutch have opted out, haven't they? The Dutch Parliament have voted to suspend arms sales to the Saudis, whilst the British government still dismisses these reports as hearsay.
Yes, the Dutch in the middle of March did vote to halt weapons exports to Saudi Arabia, and that came on the back of a European Parliament resolution calling on member states to suspend their arms sales to Saudi and its coalition partners. But unfortunately, that European Parliament resolution was non-binding. So it's still up to individual member states to decide. The Netherlands, to their credit, in my opinion, decided to halt weapons exports. And I believe that we will only see increased pressure on the UK Parliament and indeed others around Europe to do the same.
Elizabeth, you travelled in Yemen at a time when few others from the West would venture there, and you've written about one of the more unexpected side effects of the war, which, in fact, you've just mentioned it, the resurgence of al-Qaeda in the region. Let's go back a bit. How did they come to have a stronghold in Yemen?
Well, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as it's now known, really started to take off at the end of the first decade of this century. You know, between 2006 and 2009, they were gathering pace, particularly as the hunt for militant jihadists in Saudi Arabia hotted up and many moved across the border into Yemen, which, of course, has the topography of that's ideal for melting into in order to hide yourself and prepare attacks. But actually, al-Qaeda had been fairly successfully reined in when it had tried to expand into Emirates in 2011 and 2012 in the center of Yemen. The military had cracked down on it. It was forced to disband towards the east and sort of melt away into tribal heartlands. This war, when it kicked off, with the airstrikes at least, in March last year, provided an ideal opportunity for these jihadist groups to regroup, to expand their control and influence, and to position themselves as the defenders of the people against what really were perceived as land grabs by the north of Yemen. Hence, we see al-Qaeda harnessing a kind of rhetoric of Sunni-Shiite discord, which amongst the population proper was probably still perceived as territorial and political ambition. It was turned into their advantage.
LNL on RN, and you can listen to us live or via podcast on your phone or tablet. And we're talking to Elizabeth Kendall from Pembroke College in Oxford. Now, this particular branch, I understand, were the group who trained those behind the attack on Charlie Headbone.
It was this particular group, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who had helped to train those who carried out the attack on Charlie Hebdo. That's correct. But that doesn't mean to say that it was actually plotted centrally. What it goes to show is that when you have a safe haven to which terrorists internationally can travel and be trained and be part of a bigger movement that indoctrinates them further and gives them military training, then we have a problem on our hands, because these people ultimately are able to go back to their countries of origin.
You say that one of the things which might be hard for the West to understand is that in Yemen, Al-Qaeda are, if not loved, at least tolerated. Help us understand why.
That's a good question. We always tend to focus on militant jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda in terms of their beheading videos or their very aggressive military operations. But what we don't see so much of, partly because we're not the target audience for this, are the ways in which they ingratiate into local communities, particularly marginalized communities. And so in Yemen, the state had done quite a successful job of marginalizing outlying regions, particularly in the east of Yemen. And that left not only a security vacuum, but a hearts and minds vacuum, which Al-Qaeda could appropriate, could slip into.
So I'd like your description of an evening you spent with tribal elders who moaned all night about AQ and then rushed off to a meeting with the local chapter who were fixing their road up. So you're talking about the Robin Hood effect.
I think the Robin Hood effect is a good way of describing it. You're right. Last November, when I was traveling around eastern Yemen, I met with some leaders from the community in which Al-Qaeda has now its base, Mukalla, Al-Mukalla. And whilst they, exactly as you say, bitched and moaned all night about how Al-Qaeda was putting limits on their freedom of action, when I suggested that we should continue our discussions the following day, they said, oh, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. We've got to rush back for a meeting with Al-Qaeda leaders. And, you know, I was shocked by that because the way they framed it was that, well, actually, these guys are approachable. We have a water problem in my village. It needs to be sorted out. They do quite a good job of listening and of trying to put in place urgently required community resources, water, electricity. They fix schools, even girls' schools. They mend roads. They finance community projects with money. They're not short of money. They've robbed banks. They have income from smuggling routes, of course. And they also potentially have kidnap ransoms. So when we're talking about quite a well-funded organization that understands how to get into the tribal mentality.
And they also have poetry. Let's circle back to the point that I made in the introduction. You came to travel to Yemen because you were interested in poetry. And it's through the poetry that you say plays a very strong role in winning over the aforementioned hearts and minds.
That's right. And it's surprising to us, isn't it? But imagine in the east of Yemen, where Al-Qaeda has its strongest, let's call it toleration rather than support, how does it spread its message? Because there's very little internet penetration. Literacy is low and, you know, print culture is barely around. People have more guns than they do books, according to a survey which I undertook. The same survey that I undertook in the east of Yemen had an amazing result, which was that 74% of ordinary people, tribesmen and tribeswomen, said that poetry was important in their daily lives, not just on occasions, but in their daily lives. And at the same time, I discovered that Al-Qaeda's public main publication at the time actually contained about 20% of its pages contained poetry. So this is the kind of material that our intelligence services have been, at least had been, missing, because they focus so heavily on military operations, position statements, theological interpretations of Islam. But actually, on the ground, what grabs people are the beautiful and authentic rhythms, rhymes, and language of the Al-Qaeda poetry.
Elizabeth, it has to be said that the poets aren't going to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's not all that beautiful. Let me quote one example. Is there any martyr whom we desire to be united with us in love and whose dowry is a flowing ocean of blood? I suppose it might have sounded better in the original.
It did sound better in the original. I remember those lines very well. And, you know, what we miss is the whole historical baggage and authenticity that comes with using the kind of language that they use, the kind of antiquated Arabic that they put into their poetry, and the lilt and the rhyme. I mean, imagine when you're trying to prevent terrorist ideas from spreading, you can't guard against what's already in the collective memory. They're catchy lines, and they use images, blood, the rewards, the images of heaven and hell that resound across Arabic poetry. It's just that they inject it with a more militant agenda.
And as you point out, we're talking about an oral culture.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, this jumps checkpoints. This moves around. Just on the wind, so to speak. It doesn't require strong networks to make it shift. These ideas take root and they travel because they're in people's minds.
You've obviously got far deeper into the culture than other academics or observers. You've spent so much time amongst tribal groups. You're a sort of honorary member of one of them.
Well, I have been trying to help the tribal groups that exist in the far east of Yemen, the Al-Mahra tribes, in their quest to build up their communities, partly just because they need to do that in order to provide a future for their children, but partly also to steel themselves against potential incursions by groups like Al-Qaeda. When children have no prospects, no hope, no economy other than the smuggling economy, and have been marginalized by the state, it's very easy for them to be exploited, and they're enticed into joining such groups in ways that we don't even think about. Camping trips, sports events. It's much more sophisticated than we imagine.
Elizabeth, I thank you very much for that. Dr. Elizabeth Kendall, Senior Research Scholar at Pembroke College in Oxford. We'll stay in touch, Elizabeth. Meanwhile, this is LNL on RN. And up next, Anat Admati on Naughty Banks. ¶¶